Turn with me this evening to Job chapter 21. In just a minute, we're going to resume our study at verse 27. Just to get a running start here, since we've been away from this study for a few weeks. In the previous chapter, you'll recall that Job's friend Zophar had chimed in once again to respond to what Job had said in chapter 19, not only about his own pitiable condition, but about the insensitivity of his so-called friends to the same. Of course, that was only a very small part of what Job had said, because most of the chapter is about Job's frustration, not only with God himself, but also with the cold shoulder that he had received, not just from his three friends who were there, but from his relatives, his maids and servants, his own wife, his children, and his associates. His speech did end on a high note, at least initially, when he expressed his confidence that despite everything he had experienced up to this point, he knew his Redeemer lived. He says, "I know my Redeemer lives, and that one day he'll take his stand on the earth." Now, this was all well and good, again, up to a certain point, but then Job saw fit to take one more jab at his friends. He warned them, "Be afraid of the sword for yourselves, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, so that you may know there is judgment." And how did Zophar respond to that? Well, instead of actually listening to what Job was saying and taking it to heart, instead of rejoicing with Job with regard to what would have been a bombshell revelation about the living Christ, the living Lord, the coming Redeemer, the bodily resurrection from the dead. Remember, this was all new and had only been recently revealed to Job by way of direct revelation. Instead of reveling in that, instead of joining in Job's joy over this realization that his Redeemer lives, Zophar is fixated on what he considers to be an unfair assault on his and his friend's character. He says, basically, "Everything you've been saying about us is so inflammatory and so disheartening that I'm too agitated internally to withhold a response." You know, that's kind of ironic, isn't it? "I'm so upset, I can't even respond." And what does he do? He goes on and on in his response, in his defense of himself and their friends. Again, whereas Job's friends should have felt pity and compassion for him, and he's requested this a few times now, all they can think about is themselves. Job has poured out his heart time and time again about the extent of his horrible suffering. And all Zophar can think to say in the moment is, "What did you say about me?" Right? You ever know anybody like that? Where you might be pouring your heart out and you might be talking for quite a long time about the things that are bothering you, the things that are causing you so much distress, and people get hung up on one little thing that you say, and they just can't let it go. And then they retort back after you're done talking. They respond back with something about a thing that you didn't even remember saying, really. Well, this is kind of what Job's friends are like. They're nitpicking his speeches. They're finding only the negative aspects of his speech with regard to themselves. It hasn't dawned on them yet that their friend is in dire straits. Their friend needs their compassion. He needs their understanding. And more than anything, he needs to be able to vent his frustrations to them. That's what true friendship is. You know, it's the person who loves us enough to not, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, to not take into account a wrong suffered, to bear with them, to believe all the good about them, and so on and so forth. But Job's friends, again, are more self-centered than that, and they seem to think more about themselves than anything else. Sadly, I think Job had every reason to rebuke them for their insensitivity as it was being displayed toward him. Now, Zophar never relents, really, on his being offended. And really, he's disinterested in whether or not what Job was saying in total was actually true. Again, he's nitpicking what Job is saying. This is why he even goes so far as to double down in his insistence that Job was, in fact, by all appearances, a wicked man who was simply being punished as had other wicked men been punished throughout the history of mankind. Again, they're taking umbrage at what Job has said about their character, and they're using that to find a way to accuse him of evil. They are assaulting him in return to what they perceive is an assault of them in an incredibly cruel series of indictments. Zophar pulled out all the stops in order to make Job feel as guilty as his friends believed him to be. Here in chapter 21, Job responds to Zophar's unkind and insensitive assessment of him, and he does so by explaining that his complaint was really not so much about them as it was a complaint against God himself. And we've seen that. Job really rides very close to the edge when it comes to disrespecting God. And again, he doesn't understand much of what he's saying doctrinally or theologically. The aperture of God's revelation had not opened to the extent where he would be able to kind of hold back on some of the things he was saying. Most of the things he's saying are out of bewilderment, out of not having any answers, out of believing that if anything is happening to me, it's God's doing. So this is why I'm suffering so horribly. Little did Job know that was actually true, but not in the sense that he thought it was. He thought God was angry with him. He thought God was displeased with him. And that couldn't be farther from the truth, right? And so, again, having no way of knowing that, we can kind of understand why Job is constantly asking God, God, why are you picking on me? What have I done? You know, and at some point, Job begins to question, am I the wicked person that these men are accusing me of being? I don't know, because I have no answers. Remember what he said. He said, if I could appeal to God himself, if I could just talk to him face to face, I would have the answers that I seek. But that's not possible, at least in the way that he envisioned it might be possible. Job continues dismantling Zophar's argument about the fate of the wicked, though, by calling into question his primary premise concerning the fate of the wicked. Does the wicked man meet an undesirable end? Let me just ask that. Yes. Yeah, eventually. The wicked man will meet an undesirable end, but it's not always immediate, as Zophar had insisted. Zophar had in his mind that the wicked man always falls prey to the immediate consequences of his wickedness, as it seems as Job is falling prey to his wickedness. I don't know where he got that. Job doesn't even know where he got that, because you'll recall what Job questions is, you know, basically, Zophar, where are you getting your data? Because what I'm seeing and what others have seen is exactly the opposite of that. The wicked man, more than anything, prospers. More times than not, the wicked man lives to a ripe old age, and nothing is ever done to him this side of glory. Now, as Steve just pointed out, eventually in, you know, the judgment to come, he'll get his comeuppance. The wicked man will get the full weight of God's wrath for his wickedness. But not until then will that happen. There will be a day of reckoning, but it won't come immediately. And in some cases, it won't come even quickly when it comes to those who live wicked lives. Job goes on to say in verse 16, and I'm paraphrasing here, he says, look, whatever prosperity the wicked enjoys, it's not from their own hands, but from the very God that they reject. This, in turn, simply validates their wickedness. As for my situation, however, far be it from me to live according to their counsel. Job's saying, I know wicked men. I know how they live. I know how they behave. And far be it from me to ever act that way. I'm not behaving that way. I never have. I never will by God's grace. In verse 17, he carries his argument further, saying, how often is the lamp of the wicked put out, or does their calamity fall on them? Does God apportion destruction in his anger? Are they as straw before the wind and like chaff which the storm carries away? Again, Job's point is that although God's wrath will eventually fall on the wicked, although they are sometimes sent to an early grave, this is not the norm. This is not always the case. In fact, God's punishment of the wicked seems to be the exception, in Job's mind at least. In verses 19 through 21, you'll recall Job says to his friends, "You say God stores away a man's iniquity for his sons. Let God repay him so that he may know it. Let his own eyes see his decay, and let him drink of the wrath of the Almighty. For what does he care for his household after him when the number of his months is cut off?" This is really just another way for Job to separate himself from the category of the wicked. And again, I want us to think about this very carefully. If, as Job's friend Zophar has just suggested, if God brings swift destruction on the wicked, then why is it that more often than not, it's the wicked man's children who are left to pay the price for his wickedness, at least in the sense of the affairs of the world? Now again, the wicked man's going to get his what's coming to him in the afterlife, but this is a really good question. And Job is actually making the best point against Zophar's argument. He's like, "Zophar, you know for yourself that more often than not, the wickedness perpetrated by the man here on the earth is visited upon the second and third generations. The wickedness that men do on this earth is more often than not repaid by the sacrifices that have to be made by his sons." I had a friend years and years ago. He stood to gain a really lofty inheritance. While his father was alive, he was a multimillionaire. His father was alive, he had a cadre of lawyers around him. He was always able to inoculate himself from prosecution. He was always just able to get enough relief to where he could maintain his riches and so on and so forth. His sons knew nothing about it. Well, when he died, what happened? It all came back. And to this day, his sons have nothing because the federal government came in. Once all the cases for tax evasion and all the cases for fraud and all those things that he had been inoculated from, once those things came to a head, they lost everything. And so here's the rich man. You know, he departed this earth. Really, still a rich man. He's going to get his in the end, but it didn't spare his sons. And his sons paid a hefty price for the sins of their father. As for Job, this is certainly not the case. I mean, what's Job's situation in terms of his family? You know, this would have been really the most cruel argument Zophar could have made. Any talk about the wickedness of the father being passed down for the sons to have to pay for. Where are Job's sons? They're dead. They're gone. Job has lost everything. So the gall of his friends to bring this kind of argument before him is just not only insensitive, it's unthinkable that they would go in that direction, especially given that Job has lost all of his children. And instead of being put to death by God for his alleged wickedness, Job is living proof that God will allow the allegedly wicked to continue to suffer. If all the things you're saying about me is true, I should be dead right now. If all the things you're saying about me are true, then God would have preserved my family, my sons, so that my wickedness could be passed on to them, as you say. None of those things were true. Very little of what Zophar had to say about the fate of the wicked seemed to apply to Job. And in light of this, Job asks rhetorically in verse 22, "Can anyone teach God knowledge in that he judges those on high?" In other words, God doesn't need to be taught the proper way of dealing with the wicked. He judges even the most powerful of beings. And as for the fate of man, Job goes on to suggest that it's completely up to God how and when they die. And that's true. He says in verses 23 through 26, "One dies in his full strength, being wholly at ease and satisfied. His sides are filled out with fat, and the marrow of his bones is moist. While another dies with a bitter soul, never even tasting anything good. Together they lie down in the dust, and worms cover them." I mean, that's a really important point as well. Rich people don't die at any different rate than poor people do. They all go to the same place. They all go into the grave, right? And this is Job's entire point. God is not, as Zophar suggested, duty-bound to follow a precise pattern relative to the wicked man's death as opposed to any other man's death. The way that Job was seemingly being taken out of this world had nothing to do with whether he was wicked or not. These kinds of things happen to everybody. God not being a respecter of persons is another good indication that this is true. Job was simply shuffling off this mortal coil in the way that God had sovereignly decreed, as we all will. And this brings us to verse 27, where Job continues in his response to Zophar. He says, "Behold, I know your thoughts and the plans by which you would wrong me." In other words, Job's saying, I know what you're thinking. You're simply planning your next move in terms of proving that I'm wicked. This is what you've been up to the whole time. You're on this unending quest to have me declared wicked, and I'm not wicked, and yet you still persist in your arguments that I am. He goes on saying, "For you say, where is the house of the nobleman, and where is the tent, the dwelling places of the wicked?" Job knew that the first thing Zophar and company would ask would be, "Okay, so if the wicked do in fact prosper, then where are their houses? Where do they live?" This is another instance in which our English translations could be much better. Job's actually using Zophar's anticipated question to demonstrate just how foolish his statement was concerning the fate of the wicked. Evidence of the wicked man's prosperity is all around us. Have you ever driven through the Dominion? Do you suppose that the great majority of people living in the Dominion are Bible-believing Christians? Probably not. Look at Forbes' list of the richest men in the world. I looked at the top 20, and aside from the Waltons, who own Walmart, who profess to be Christians, there's not a Christian among them in the top 20. And so this, and look at their homes. You can actually go and look up their homes. They live in the most opulent mansions. So Zophar's suggestion that, "Oh, well, where are their houses?" Well, they're all around you. And it was the same back then. People used to live in lavish palaces and mansions, and those homes were usually built on the backs of those that they had disenfranchised, those that they had mistreated, those that they used for slave labor, and so on and so forth. The wicked man's home is not hidden. So it's kind of a silly question that's being asked here. And this becomes even more clear in verse 29, where Job asks, "Have you not asked wayfaring men," that is, travelers who have traveled far and wide, "and do you not recognize their witness?" In other words, have you never spoken to those who routinely go out and travel abroad? They will be the first to tell you that they've seen with their own eyes these lavish mansions and palaces in which the most wicked men live. In fact, the same thing again can be seen even in our own day, as I just said. You know, I'd love to see a poll taken of the richest people in the world, a poll regarding their faith or their lack thereof. I think it'd be very telling, right? The wicked do prosper. That's the point. He goes on to offer even more proof of this, suggesting that not only do they prosper in life, but also in death. Go to the cemetery in the Dominion. I'm talking about the fancy part of the cemetery. Really, any cemetery of any good-sized city. Go and find where the wealthiest people are buried, and what do you see? You see the most lavish tombs. You know, I mean, we struggled to get my dad a headstone, and these people have like little concrete houses in some cases. Right, with big marble monuments even in death. And this is Job's point. Verse 30, the wicked is reserved for the day of calamity. They will be led forth at the day of fury. And this is just a parenthetical way of saying while the wicked man will in fact get what's coming to him in the day of judgment, it won't be until then that the final verdict is read. While he lives, Job writes in verse 31, he says, while he lives, the wicked man is veritably untouchable by any of his detractors. He asks, who will confront him with his actions and who will repay him for what he has done? This actually fits the mold of my friend and his father. He was untouchable. He had such good legal representation. He had so many friends in high places, no one could ever get to him. Almost like a mob boss, right? But let me just tell you again, if you inherit the gains of a mob boss, you're not going to hold on to those too long because they're coming after you. I mean, unless you've been groomed to be a mob boss yourself, and at that point, you know, all bets are off anyway. But we see this playing out before us all the time. How many rich and powerful figures ever get prosecuted for the crimes they commit? You ever wondered that? You know, we read in the news of crimes being perpetrated by these people in the higher echelon of human existence, and we just have to scratch our heads and wonder why are, you know, if I did that, if I wiped computers owned by the government of all the evidence that might prosecute me, including classified evidence, they wouldn't put me in jail. They'd throw me under the jail and forget I was there. And yet, certain unnamed individuals can get by with that sort of thing, right? I mean, I even have it on good authority that if you have the right father, you can actually smoke dope and do crack in the White House and leave it laying around, and nothing will happen to you. It's unjust, right? It's unthinkable that that would happen. But here's the point. It happens. In the realm of the rich and famous, they can do almost anything and get away with it. You ever wonder where Epstein's guest list is? You ever wonder what happened to the list of P. Diddy's patrons? You don't think there's a cabal at work to keep all that under wraps so that no one gets prosecuted for it? You don't think that on those lists there aren't really high-profile people? This is Job's point. The rich man is untouchable even in life. During his life, no one is going to come to him with these types of questions, asking him to give an account for his wickedness. In fact, Job goes on to suggest the wicked man also enjoys the benefits of his riches even in death. Verses 32 and 33. While he's carried to the grave, men will keep watch over his tomb. The clods of the valley will gently cover him. Moreover, all men will follow after him, while countless ones go before him. He's talking about the procession. Rich men normally enjoy grand burials. People going before, people following behind. And have you ever noticed at their funerals? I mean, you can talk about the most evil man imaginable, and at their funeral, everybody speaking will have nothing but good things to say about that person. This is Job's point. And even today, this type of thing happens. So again, Job is spot on here, which leads him to ask his friends in verse 34, how then will you vainly comfort me, for your answers remain full of falsehood? In other words, how can you ever expect to console me when everything you've said about me is based on lies? You can't hug me and stab me in the back at the same time. Right? And note this, Job's friends were not only guilty of lying about him, but they were also guilty of lying about God. Once again, Barnes is helpful here, commenting on this verse. He says, that is, how can you be qualified to give me consolation in my trials who have such erroneous views of the government and dealings of God. True consolation could be founded only on correct views of the divine government. But such views, Job says, they had not. With their conceptions of the divine administration, they could not administer to him any real consolation. We may learn hence, one, that all real consolation in trial must be based on correct apprehensions of the divine character and plans. Falsehood, delusions, error can give no permanent comfort. And two, those whose office it is to administer consolation to the afflicted should seek after the truth about God and His government. And I think Barnes is correct here. One of the most important things to consider when we attempt to console others who are suffering in some way is not to begin by questioning their character. And yet that happens too, right? I've given you the example of the man born blind. You know, their first question was, why was he born this way? Was it his sin or his parents' sin that caused him to be born this way? And little did they know, and they were probably greatly perplexed when Christ answered and said, it's not for either of those things. It's so that the glory of God might be shown in his healing. You mean to tell me that God would have a man be born blind and live for ostensibly some 30 years? They think he was probably around that same age. Live that long in complete darkness just so he could make a point about his glory? Absolutely. Their failure, the reason they asked that question, was actually predicated on their lack of real knowledge of who God is. Job's friends are the same way. You're saying these things about me, and you're saying these things about me reveals not only that you don't know as much about me as you pretend to know, but you don't know as much about God as you pretend to know. Right? Again, remember what Job's hanging on to. I know my Redeemer lives. He'll say, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. So he's got this kernel of real abiding faith. It's shaky. Whose wouldn't be when you're covered with boils and you've lost everything that's dear to you? And yet he's hanging on to that. Why? Because he knows God. And he knows that God never does anything in a willy-nilly, capricious fashion. There must be a good reason why God is allowing this. But again, Job just doesn't know what that reason is. He can't know. As I've said many times before, a great number of the problems that can exist among believers interpersonally is actually the result of a failure to understand God. Everything we believe about everything spins off of our theology proper. What we know about God will affect every other thing that we think we know about everything else. It all begins with Him. Once we understand that God very often causes pain and suffering to befall His children simply as a means of displaying something about Himself, only then can our approach be more compassionate. Only then can our approach be more balanced in that regard. So, this finally did the trick, right? Job's friends realized they'd made a huge mistake. They apologized, and they all lived happily ever after. No. Verse 1 of chapter 22. Then Eliphaz. It's almost comical at this point, right? Eliphaz the Temanite responded, can a vigorous man be of use to God or a wise man be useful to himself? Is there any pleasure to the Almighty if you are righteous, or prophet if you make your ways perfect? Is it because of your reverence that he reproves you, that he enters into judgment against you? Is not your wickedness great and your iniquities without end? Here again, Eliphaz actually proves that what Job said at the end of the previous chapter is absolutely correct. Eliphaz didn't really know God either. It's quite evident. Once again, as we noted at the beginning of our study of this book, God was, in fact, allowing Satan to test Job in some of the most unimaginable ways. In fact, he gave Satan the leeway to test Job to the extent that he might die. But he said, do anything to him you like, but don't kill him. Don't do anything that might take his life. God was, in fact, allowing this to happen because, not in spite of, but because of Job's righteous standing before him. Have you tried my servant Job? That's an open gauntlet throw to Satan. Job is one of my finest specimens of righteousness. Again, now that we know the full story, Job is standing firmly in the righteous robes of Jesus Christ. Try him as you might, you'll not win. And what a joy it is to know that the same thing is true about us. When Satan starts hurling his fiery darts in our direction, he has to know, he does know that he'll never succeed where God's people are concerned. No enemy formed against you will prosper. What a relief that is. What a blessing to know that. When Eliphaz asks, is there any pleasure to the Almighty if you're righteous, or profit if you make your ways perfect? This is a sure indication that he knows nothing about God and his workings in and among his children to accomplish his divine purposes. God does, in fact, delight in our holiness and our righteousness. Why? Because he delights in his son. Remember, it pleased God to crush his son. And those who are securely in his son, God finds the same delight in us through him. And that's a tremendous blessing as well. For example, we're told in Psalm 33:5, he loves righteousness and justice, which means he loves those who have been declared righteous and just through his son. In Psalm 149:4, we're told the Lord takes pleasure in his people. He will beautify the afflicted ones with salvation. In Proverbs 3:12, we read, the Lord reproves him whom he loves as a father, the son in whom he delights. Now, having said that, let me just also give you a word of caution when it comes to properly understanding this kind of thing. Eliphaz is right about one thing here, and that is that God does not profit from us. Now, how can we say that? Well, if God profits from us in any way, that destroys his immutability. To say that God profits from us would be to imply that at some point there was something he lacked, and that something was only that which we could supply. God doesn't profit from you. God is glorified in the grace that he has dispensed to you, but it's not to his profit. Neither are the lost a detriment to who he is. If you're saved, you're saved by God's grace and for his glory alone. You don't add to him. You don't take anything away from him. And this is really what makes the modern, so-called modern gospel, so egregious. This idea that God is helpless and God just kind of worries in heaven. Just, won't you come, please, choose me, please pick me. Because I'm sad when you don't. Have you ever told your children, by the way? Maybe you can admit to it long ago, hopefully not recently, but anybody ever tell your children that when they sin, it makes God sad? Irma's brave enough to admit that, right? Yes, okay, that was you. Yeah. Do you realize how patently absurd that is? The idea that we can elicit any emotional change in God, much less any other change, is patently absurd, and really it goes beyond that. It's blasphemy. Why? Because his sovereign immutability and his impassibility do not allow for any changes in his essential being. And to think that we have the power and control to do that, Be careful. It's just not true. But that doesn't mean that he doesn't take pleasure in his children and their standing in his grace, as I just said. In verse 4, intending to further humiliate Job, Eliphaz asks, is it because of your reverence that he reproves you, that he enters into judgment against you? Once again, the New American Standard could be a little clearer here. Eliphaz is actually asking Job, do you think God's reproving you because he's afraid that you might harm him in some way? That's actually what the Hebrew translates as. Both things are true, by the way. I mean, little did Eliphaz know. Yeah, that's exactly the reason, Eliphaz. You know, if you even take the New American Standard translation of this, yeah, God is reproving you because you're righteous. But the tenor is, Eliphaz was suggesting Job might think that God's reproving him because God's actually afraid of him. That's absurd, right? As Gill noted, as the goodness of men does not profit him, the sinfulness of men does not hurt him. And that's the whole point that I was making a minute ago. Eliphaz is simply attempting to prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that even though Job might claim to be innocent, he's not. In fact, in verse 5, Eliphaz just comes right out with it. Is not your wickedness great and your iniquities without end? What a silly question. What a selfish question. What a self-centered way of viewing what's happening to Job. He then goes on in verse 6 to give Job specific examples of charges that could be and likely had been made against him. Lord willing, we'll pick up there in our next study. But let me just point out once again that our primary takeaway from what we've looked at tonight is very clear. Number one, we should always avoid presumption. We should always avoid presumption when it comes to what others may be going through, because we have no way of knowing what God's doing behind the scenes and why. Don't even pretend to know. And two, although we'll never completely understand the mind of God and the workings of God, we can and should make it our settled habit to learn more about Him through the diligent study of His Word. Get to know the God of the Scriptures. You know, people tell me a lot, you know, I have trouble understanding this part of the Bible or that part of the Bible. I suggest that you get a really good systematic theology. Robert Raymond has written one of the better systematic theologies. I believe it's even called the New Systematic Theology. Now, it's written from a Presbyterian point of view, but, you know, again, they're right on probably 99% of the things they teach. So you would do well to own a copy of that. It's a fairly thick copy. His portions on the doctrine of God are so rich. I would also recommend Gill's Body of Divinity. That's another rich resource on the doctrine of God. And if you have the stomach for it, and you have enough time to sit and scratch your noggin enough, James Dozal's All That Is in God. All that is in God? All that is God. All that is in God. Ron's shaking his head. Ron will agree, too. It's like taking a sip of water from a fire hydrant. James Dozal, yeah, Dolezal. Another excellent work on the doctrine of God. Get to know God. And then you'd be amazed at how much clearer the things in His Word become when you have a better understanding of who God is.